Life Management Science Labs would like to acknowledge that we live and produce this podcast on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. We'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands of our listeners and our international colleagues. We'd like to thank and pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Room by Room, the Home Organization Science Insights podcast, produced by LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. We're champions of life management science, providing structured insights informed by science and inspired by practice on key aspects of conscious living. Each week, we bring you scientific and practical insights on each element with the expert knowledge of professionals in the field. I'm your host, Gabriella Yastra, coming to you from NAM, Melbourne, Australia. Let's begin. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the show. Today, we're going to be unleashing the potential of small floor plans for optimal use and well-being with Anna Power, who is a registered architect at Studio Esther. Hi, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Gabriella. It's lovely to be here.
Great to have you here. Before we get going and learning more about floor plans, I'd love to learn a little bit more about who you are. So do you mind introducing yourself?
So I am a registered architect. I've been practicing for about more than 30 years now, which seems unbelievable. And I now run my own practice, Studio Esther. I have predominantly worked in residential and domestic architecture during that time, but I've had a couple of other little experiences too, some time in Hong Kong. And as we were chatting about earlier, I worked on the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne. So I am also a mother of two, and I've got two teenage daughters, so that's also part of what I get up to.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you must be busy with two teenagers.
Yes, it's actually become really fun now as they've got older, but busy.
Yeah, I'm sure. Two teenagers, I mean, they'd be much more interesting, but... I guess more adult-like, you can start having, I guess, some of the same interests, as opposed to like when they're kids and they're just interested in Pokemon.
Yeah, no, they've definitely got to an age where they're really very much developing their own opinions and interests and things. So it is, I feel like I've got two flatmates now rather than two children. They've probably got just beyond that area where they need any real discipline or anything. It's kind of, they're sort of individuals now. So it's quite fun.
Oh yeah, that's great. So we're going to do a section we call Have You Met Anna. That's where we get to learn a few more things about you. So the first thing I'd like to learn is, what's your favorite book?
Yes, that was a tricky question, Gabriella, because I actually love reading, and I call it lazy sometimes because I very much read for entertainment most of the time. So I thought I'd think of something I'd read recently, which was Demon Copperhead, which is a book by Barbara Kingsolver. And it's really it's not a happy read. It's quite sad in parts, but a really very clever personal story, but also with a really strong, quite a strong political message. And it's actually modelled on David Copperfield, which is not a book I've read, but I do feel I might read that now. She's a terrific author.
So what is the book about?
Well, it's set in the Appalachia, and she is Barbara Kingsolver's Appalachian, and it's interesting. I've read a number of her books, and each one is quite different. So she's someone who researches a topic, but she also has described how this is quite personal to her, because whilst she's got out of that area of America and become a very successful author, she's very fond of her culture and her beginnings, and she's quite upset by the poverty and the neglect that's occurred to those areas in America. Also, there's a sort of theme around some of the drug problems with the opioid epidemic,
yes,
which has had a really big impact on that zone as well. So she sort of has brought that into a fictional story where we're quite attached to this main character, Demon, which is his nickname, and that sort of takes us on this journey which where we are exposed to some of these really quite horrific results of the opioid epidemic, but, you know, interwoven with a really sort of quite a beautiful story of him growing up. So, like, it's really quite a powerful book.
Wow, sounds interesting, but also a bit tough to read. But I think not all books should be easy to read, I think.
No, and look, I'm the first one to say I'll give a book up if I think, oh, it's just too hard. So she's definitely managed to sort of weave a story that's compelling, you know, and it was one of those books that I you know, didn't want to put it down. I really needed to understand what was going to happen. And, you know, so she has kind of managed to make it compelling, but there's a pretty strong message as well.
That's great when, yeah, you can marry that really compelling, really good story and, you know, very hard to put it down with something that has such a great message.
Yeah, look, I think when you've got those, when someone's clever enough that they can have something operating on those different levels, you know, that you're just getting this sort of layering and it's and complexity that, you know, yeah, it was quite fabulous. I'm also very fond of just reading really easy books as well. So, you know, but this one was quite compelling. So, yeah, I've really enjoyed that recently.
Yeah, I think it's good to mix things up a bit. Have some easy books, have some hard books.
Yeah, I do. I try to do that. I've probably got about 6 or 7 books sitting on my bedside table. A couple have been sitting there for a long time and I still feel that I'm going to be determined to read them, but something always gets in the way.
Mm-hmm. Same here. One day I'll read The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Well, now I've got to read David Copperfield, but I couldn't even find it at the bookstore. I think too many people have had the same sort of idea, perhaps.
Yeah, I put a few reservations at the library for a few books and I got them ages later. I was like, I can't even remember ordering this book. I guess I'll read it now because obviously it's in such high demand. So, yeah, I can see that.
Oh, that's a great idea. I used to go to the library all the time and I think because of our break during COVID, I've got a little bit out of that habit. So, yeah, that's a great idea. I'll have to go and reserve it.
Yeah, it's so good as well. I love free books. have you watched any movies recently?
Well, I'm going to go there. I saw Barbie, you know, a week and a half ago with my younger teenage daughter, and I will mention it. It'll very much date us, but I really, really enjoyed it, and she really enjoyed it, and the friend that we went with really enjoyed it. I thought it was quite a sort of spectacular film, really. I was just didn't know what to expect.
It was quite different from what I was expecting. I was expecting it to be set a lot more in Barbie Land, and I thought it'd be maybe like your run-of-the-mill, like, Barbie thing, you know, something happens and they fix it and they go, yay. And they sort of did that, but a lot more deeper, I think, than I was expecting.
Oh, look, I think it was an incredible thing to pull off in such a sort of commercial environment. I was staggered that, it was really... it was quite controversial in parts. It was some of the script was kind of complex. You know, I mean, they did use the word existential and, you know, there was, but they also made fun of that. You know, the sets were visually sort of a spectacular, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, I will go back just to look at the Barbie house in more detail because I was, you know, I'd like to spend more time just looking at all those beautiful kind of details in Barbie Land. I can't believe we talk about Barbie Land. But, yeah, I mean, it was really impressive, especially, I just wasn't sure how they could have pulled it off.
Yeah, it's amazing. I've seen some of those videos about how they made the set on Instagram and, yeah, they, like, hand-painted a lot of the skies, all the set pieces. They're all real. They're not much CGI, I think.
Yeah,
so
right.
So it's really, really amazing.
Yeah. No, well, look, I a number of years ago when we were in overseas, my daughters really wanted to go to the Harry Potter kind of sets, mm-hmm. and that had a very similar thing, that when we went there was just the craft was extraordinary, and you know, seeing how everything was put together and that it wasn't all CGI. There was enormous use of people's sort of technical skills to construct things and everything, which I think is a really lovely part of it, that the making of the sets and all that creativity is extraordinary.
I love to like learn how to do some of those things. I don't know, carving, how do you make paper look old, all of those things. Yeah. I just love learning how things are made.
I know. And just I think that attention to detail, it must be really rewarding. But you do sort of, I think what really struck me with the film was how much it sort of came together. It had this kind of cohesion when it was so sort of silly in, you know, in many parts. I mean, the Kens all dancing and, you know, like it was just, but the cohesion of it was quite amazing. And I think probably contrasting with a lot of films that disappoint on that level, where mm-hmm. they don't quite pull that off, or you just think, gosh, that could have had a bit more editing, or, you know, you could see that film, they put a lot of time into it.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you listen to any podcasts?
I am a listener to podcasts. Mm-hmm. I have I like to listen to them when I'm drawing. I was thinking about, I think one of my favourites was a podcast called Heavyweight. I don't know if you've ever listened to that one.
I've heard of it, but I haven't actually listened to it. It's been advertised too much and it's put me off.
Well, I think it became very popular, mm-hmm. And someone had recommended it to me. And I think what's appealing about it is actually, if someone told you what it was about, you would never be able to do it justice of why it works. But it really, I think, captures a lot about what's great with podcasts is it's just really personal and it's storytelling. And the host is very amusing, and it's quite moving, some of the stories. So I think that's what I really like about it is it's intriguingly simple, but it's sort of very powerful and funny too. Mm. So, that's a bit of a favourite. I am one of those people who loves true crime podcasts.
I mean, that's how I got into it. So I think no shame there.
Yeah, I know. It's just a bit. Anyway, I think it's too, because I like, I love listening to some of the women, you know, where there's a number of them have two women, which I think is really fun. I love listening to them sort of banter.
Yeah, I think because, I mean, I think the stereotype is that women really love true crime. And so I guess because then women get into podcasting it, that's another aspect that we like, is we like listening to women.
Yeah,
as well, and their opinions and, yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of a couple of girlfriends kind mm-hmm. of talking when, you know, and I might do some work in the evening drawing or something when, you know, the phone's not ringing anymore and I've got a couple of girlfriends chattering in my
ears. Yeah.
Keeping me entertained. So, yeah, I listen quite widely to lots of different things. So I think it's a wonderful medium.
Well, thank you. Yes, I agree, and that's why I'm here today, because I love yeah. podcasts.
No, I think there's an opportunity to have some more depth, which is refreshing when everything's always so rushed.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. And do you have a role model?
I was thinking a lot about role models, because I think as an architect in my 50s, I'd had a long time where I didn't have a lot of, well, I hadn't worked with older women architects, and it's something that I really missed that I think has been identified, that sort of pathway or seeing another, you know, how that might be done or, you know, what you're identifying with. But when I moved to Melbourne, I had a couple of years working on the Royal Children's Hospital, and it was one of the most lovely things was I actually worked with a couple of women who are a little bit older than me, and I really hadn't had that experience before, and I think it was really great to sort of see how they managed their lives, their families, you know, they were, one in particular was incredibly generous with her knowledge, and it you know, I really enjoyed it. So that was something. And, you know, otherwise I sort of always joke about a couple of my friends that I was at uni with that they're my role models because we're all still practicing architecture, and we have all, I wouldn't say we're pioneers, we're probably a little bit young for that, but certainly there's been an issue around women dropping out of architecture, and it is, you know, it has been something that the industry is trying to address. And so it does become apparent as you get older, there are less older women architects practicing. So, yes, we all try to kind of support each other.
Do you think that's because just, I guess, parenthood often takes women out of the market, or are there other factors involved?
Look, I think that, you know, the commitment that it can take and the amount of hours that can occur in practice, it can be very difficult to balance that, particularly as you become more senior. None of us want to own up to, you know, excessive overtime or anything like that. But, you know, there is a lot of they're busy jobs, and with the interaction with construction and this sort of thing, you know, they can be very hectic. And I think it is hard if you have a fairly primary role as a carer for your kids, or, you know, that it becomes, there's a lot of pressure coming from a few different directions. So I think that can have an impact.
Interesting. I guess I'd never thought about who architects are. Maybe if you'd asked me, I'd say a 30-something man.
Look, I think that's, you know, I think that sort of is not uncommon at all, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, there is an affiliation with a construction site. So mm-hmm. you are in, you know, that is still a very male industry, although you're seeing more women in the trades, which is really great to see. Mm-hmm. Because I think, you know, construction's a really interesting area. And, you know, I think there's been a lot of change in what's seen acceptable in these kind of workplaces and things, which I think are a real positive.
Yeah, and it's great that you were able to see some people, you know, a little bit older than you succeeding and striving. And then also, I guess, the fact that, you know, anyone else listening out there, you can see Anna here, an architect who is, you know, you can see yourself represented in her, hopefully, and keep going with that architecture degree or with your dream to be an architect. So, yeah,
yes,
thanks
that's
for joining.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Look, it's a very interesting area to be involved in. But yeah, look, at you know, there's a fair degree of commitment required.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And have you completed any courses that have inspired you?
Well, look, I think because I did a little bit of teaching myself, sort of on and off through my career, and more recently in interior design, and I went and did I do love drawing, and I went to do a drawing course, and I really enjoyed it because rather than a kind of guided drawing experience, which I've had before and a number of times, like life drawing or something, which are great, you know, just I had a real teacher who actually, we had quite a structured sort of way, and she really, you know, talked about how to improve your drawing technique and how to achieve certain things. And I really, really enjoyed that because I've done a lot of drawing on and off with, you know, live models and things like that. But this was sort of an experience where, you know, it's like it's really nice to be absolutely taught something you do not know, or a new technique or something like that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I love those kind of, I do love drawing courses, but that's been great. And I recently did the same and went into started some oil painting, which is my new thing.
Oil painting always scares me. I always think that I'm just going to drop the painting and then get it all over the carpet or something.
Well, I tried watercolours, and that was not me, because I realised that is way too sort of very delicate, and that's much more. So I found, you know, oil paintings just got a little bit, you know, it's not as unforgiving.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. So how do you define home organisation?
Well, I suppose talking about home organisation, Gabriella, is like, I suppose it's thinking about it as being a reflection of, you know, how you live in your home. Mm-hmm. So it is kind of thinking about how you operate day to day, and that's quite personal, depending on who you live with and, you know, all of those kind of things, your own habits, and then how you put your house together to sort of streamline that and to make it reflect, you know, the way you operate in your house.
Mm. And are there any misconceptions about this?
Look, I think the misconception might be that there's a perfect way to do it. And I think that we look at all these beautiful magazines and all these beautiful, you know, images of perfect, you know, houses with perfect belongings and, you know, perfect inhabitants. And it probably makes us think that it's all got to be in that sort of style. And I think that it's really important to think about your own personal style and what you want from your home. So I think it's great when you see people liberated from feeling like they've got to have this sort of fairly minimalist, or, you know, that's got to be in a particular way. And, you know, it is, I suppose the misconception would be that there's only one way to organize a home.
Mm-hmm. Yes, when I haven't tidied my home and people come in, and I try to remind myself that this is my home. I live here. It shouldn't be perfect. And just because everyone else has it one way, I might be able to have it something another way.
Yeah, look, it's I think it's great when you're in someone's home and it actually reflects their personality, and that gives you such comfort in that environment. You know, that it sort of isn't sort of textbook sort of, you know, there's a bit of bravery in the colours, you know, there might be a bit of clutter, you know, that's kind of comforting. And I think I can understand where the sort of Māori Kondo movement came from. I think that, you know, I think you do have to recognise when you've just got too much stuff and you don't need it. But I think converse to that, we don't all need to live in sort of like pristine, immaculate, pared back environments if that's not who we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So today we're going to be talking about floor plans, and I do like to start off with a few definitions so we know where we're standing. So what is a floor plan, and why should we care? Why do we need one?
Well, I suppose with a floor plan, I mean, in technical terms, we're talking about sort of looking, you know, a bird's eye view of a layout of a, you know, a house or an apartment or, you know, an area. So we've sort of got that bird's eye view. But when we're sort of thinking about it, it is, when we're working as architects, we're constantly looking at how we sort of spatially plan. We talk about it, that how we organise space to optimise the usage of it, really. And that's usually reflected in the plan.
Mm-hmm. And so what you're looking for when you're creating a floor plan, you know, you have a blank house, approximately this size and this size. And you're trying to put in walls, and you're trying to put in, I don't know, stairs and those types of things to create the floor plan. But is it important to get it right and to think about it, or you can kind of just slap in a bedroom, slap in a kitchen, wherever you like?
Look, I think some of the really important things are to think about it in its context. So the really big starting point is to think, where does the sun rise? Where does the light come from? Where's the sort of warmth? Where's the outdoor area? You know, so you're actually organising an interior floor plan really around those external forces. So you've sort of got those external context, which is really important. And then you're then thinking about the sort of functionality of the spaces. So obviously, you know, things like, yes, pop the bedroom sort of possibly around close to a bathroom. You know, we think about things, you know, you've got someone over for dinner, you don't want someone doing a sort of run through the dining room with a towel wrapped around them, you know. They're all those sort of practical things. And you'll see that constantly reflected in your more generic sort of floor plans with apartments and things. That there is a, you know, there's a better way of organising things that's quite understood. From there, when we do houses for our clients, we are listening to them about how they want to use the house. And sometimes we might say, oh, look, have you thought about the fact that that may create this or, you know, but generally we're very much, there's that sort of extra layer of personalising that floor plan.
So obviously we can't go into what every single person and every single client has ever wanted, but what are some of the general rules? You mentioned that the bathroom should be close to the bedroom. What are some other rules?
Look, I think what you want to always be thinking about is you want to think about sort of acoustic privacy and a sort of visual privacy. So you're sort of thinking about what are your sort of your almost your public zones of the house and what are your private zones? And then you sort of can sometimes really be breaking those up. One of the really big things to think about is how you circulate through the house. So how you circulate through the rooms, through the home. So we would always, when we do our floor plans, we always put furniture in them because you are circulating around that furniture and you'll find that you've got to sort of think about the circulation and about it not cutting rooms in half.
Mm-hmm.
I think in landscape architect talk, they talk about desire lines that, you know, in a park or anything, you can think that someone's going to take the path, but you see all the time that someone will cut across the grass.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a similar idea that you're sort of thinking about how do we get from the entry to the bedroom or the bathroom, and does that cut that space up?
Mm.
So that's a really big thing to think about, is how you circulate around the space and how you furnish it, because there's sort of... you've got to think about it. Like, most people like to sit in the living room and watch the television. Where's the couch go? Where's the TV go? And are you cutting across that all the time to get to the kitchen? You know, mm-hmm. So this is the sort of thing that we think through when we're organising the spaces.
Yeah, I stayed with a friend a couple months ago and I found it a bit odd that the sofa was on one side, the TV was on the other side, and between them was the path between the front door, basically. And so every time someone came in, you know, they'd cross through between the TV and the people sitting and watching, which I guess isn't a huge problem if there's only two people. But if you have a family, it could mean a lot of people, I guess, crossing between those and disturbing things.
I think even more specifically with that, it's really funny. I think it affects your perception of the space, that it can feel like that the space has just become like a big corridor.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not feeling that sort of security or containment mm-hmm. of that room or you know, that it's not relaxing because mm-hmm. it's kind of like someone's always walking through.
Yeah.
So it sort of feels like I'm sitting in a big corridor and these people keep walking around, you know. And so you sort of, it's not always possible. And, you know, sometimes, particularly with apartments and things, you know, you might have to make a compromise and it's not the end of the world, but, you know, it does help if you've located that furniture so that you genuinely know people aren't kind of trying to walk around furniture, or that you don't know where to put the furniture because mm-hmm. it actually doesn't have a logical location in the room.
Mm-hmm. And you also mentioned as well the outside influencing the inside. So I'm guessing that would be things like, you know, how much sun all the rooms get. So would I be right in thinking that the bedrooms should get, you know, the sun from the east, and then, you know, maybe the dining room gets the sun from the west, you know, according to the sunset and sunrise, or is it a bit different from that?
Look, it is it's tricky in the sense that you probably got a view, an outlook, an outdoor area. So sometimes you're sort of like dealing with that. So you might say, oh, I've got beautiful view, but it's to the south. So, you know, I'm going to try and balance that with try to bring some light in from the north regardless. But yes, I mean, really it's probably just about making those decisions and not being sort of generic in the way that you just plop a plan down. It's been a criticism of project homes, I guess, and those kind of mass housing, that they don't always offer that level of flexibility, which is a shame because I think getting that light and outlook to your living areas as a priority for most people is really makes a very big difference to how you feel.
Mm. I really love it when I get the north-facing sunlight coming into my study. It's really lovely because my cat will come and sit in the windowsill and he'll have a lovely time. Meanwhile, I'm squinting at the computer and I can't see anything.
Yeah, that's right. Like, it's you're always trying to sort of manage it. And it's like when it's beautiful to have a Western outlook, except for about 2 months of the year in Melbourne when it's just stinking hot.
So, yes.
You know, but actually other than that, you can have beautiful sunsets, you know, you get that lovely long, low afternoon light. So it is a balancing act. But I think the main thing is that you've actually thought about it, you know, and that's one of the things that is really important. We call it site analysis, where we actually, you know, really think about what is that context of where we're putting this home.
Mm-hmm. So it's not so much about following the rules and doing this, this and this, but just thinking about how you want, I guess, the inside to interact with the outside and also how you want to work in that space, and then making sure that it just works for you rather than, following a plan.
That's right. Like, I mean, I guess that's the sort of, it is bringing all those different factors together. So as I said, you know, you'll inevitably have you might have some degree of compromise on something, but at least you're making that compromise knowingly. So you're making that selection, like I'll take the beautiful view, but sort of accept that that's not the sunniest place, but then let's think about that sunny area and what can we put there to enjoy it.
Mm. And we're actually specifically talking about smaller floor plans today. So what are some of the differences when you're designing a small floor plan? What are the differences between a, you know, big floor plan or a normal, I guess, house size floor plan and the smaller floor plans, say, in an apartment?
Look, this is where you really are going to sort of look at really making the spaces work hard. So you really want to reduce things like hallways and walkways or any space that hasn't got a direct function. So it doesn't mean you want to walk straight from your front door into a space. Like we like to sort of come into perhaps a little entry area, but then that entry area, you know, you might ensure that that has some storage. So that becomes a little storage area. And then you're going to, you know, you're thinking about how those spaces work together and very importantly, how you furnish them and their aspect and everything. So you sort of, I kind of call it like you're sort of working your plan really hard to make everything, to make every square meter worth it.
And I know that, you know, sometimes we don't have a choice, you know, particularly when you first move out of home, maybe you move into an apartment and you only have a small floor plan. But, you know, if you do have a choice, are there any benefits to having a small floor plan?
Look, I think the focus for it is that we're now looking at a situation where for many people, affordability is a huge issue. So unfortunately, particularly through COVID, building costs have escalated, you know, and a lot of that is in the raw materials. So, you know, the cost of steel, concrete, timber, they've all gone up. Really, the less the materials is going to reduce your costs. You know, that's just, and the less materials, we also sort of have a sustainability aspect to that as well. So there's less obviously embodied energy within those building materials being used. So they're very much your sort of advantages. I think for some, there's an intimacy in being in a smaller floor plan, and we do have some small family units, single people, like a growing number of people who just want to live on their own. So, you know, there's a lot of those factors coming into it.
And you mentioned that you need to make the room work for you. You need to make the apartment or the floor plan work for you. What are some ways, other than, as you said, storage, what are some other ways that we can make the floor plan work for us?
I think thinking of the spaces as being flexible. So if you're in a position that you want to have something smaller and that's more affordable, there's lots of really clever ways to ensure you may have an area that you are using as a study, but, you know, the, having a pull-out bed in that room then allows that to become a guest room when it's needed. And there's a little bit of compromise, obviously, when the guests there, hope they don't stay too long, you've got your study. But just thinking about that, so we're not really looking then at one room, one function, mm-hmm. but thinking about how a room can have a few functions. Similarly, the way you might arrange your dining living, you might only have a small dining table, but if you wanted to have a dinner party, you might have an extendable table and an opportunity just to put your other furniture a little bit out of the way, extend the table and still enjoy, you know, having 8 or 10 people for dinner mm-hmm. at the table. And then obviously be able to. So looking at that kind of flexibility in the arrangements, I think, is really important. And also looking at the way that your outdoor areas can extend that space and extend that perception of space. So thinking about how you're giving that outlook to make the room not feel cramped, you know.
Is that as simple as, I guess, opening the windows so you can see outside so you feel like you have more space? Or is it, you know, maybe if you have that extendable table, maybe moving it outside. How do you include the inside with the outside?
Look, I guess a lot of the time we just look at this sort of idea of really just having some lovely big glass doors out to a balcony or a deck. And that's certainly, you know, of value. I think one of the other things to think about is really how the ceiling works and how high is the ceiling, and thinking about skylights, highlight windows and things like that. Because, again, that perception of a larger space, actually not from the plan but from what we call the section, that we don't have to have a 2.4 metre ceiling, which is our minimum requirement. We can have higher ceilings. We can have sloped ceilings. We can have, you know, beautiful barrel vaults. We can bring the light in from up, you know, from above. And that, again, gives that extension to the space. So it creates a perception of bigger space.
Mm-hmm. And what are some other ways we can kind of change our perception and make the room feel bigger than it actually is?
I think that's I think that the sort of furniture that you use, it is a good idea when you have a smaller room to not have big furniture. Mm-hmm. You don't need to have a big couch sort of for it to be a comfortable couch. So there's been a lot of love of mid-century modern furniture and the look of it and things, you know, in the last couple of years. And a large part of the appeal of the mid-century modern style is the authenticity of the materials and the warmth of a lot of that, the timbers and the fabrics and things. But a lot of that furniture is up on legs. It's not so big as some of the contemporary furniture we have now, but it's still very comfortable. So that sort of finer furniture helps with those smaller spaces, and also not overstuffing it with too many things. But again, as I said, I'm all for bringing your style in and having some beautiful objects and books, whatever you love that's comforting to you. But, you know, thinking about not having too much stuff in those spaces.
Yes. I know from experience that I don't need nearly as many things as I have in my living room, but it does make it feel a little crowded, and I probably should go through and get rid of some of it.
Yeah, look, it's a bit of an ongoing project. I think these things just sort of collect, you know.
Yeah.
We all have that. And as I said, I don't think you should, we all have to kind of become minimalist. But, you know, having that some furniture with storage in it and things like that, and putting things away and having storage, you know, you can do some really clever storage, you know, things like drawers under day beds and that kind of thing, just to help put away things, just to assist with the room feeling not too cluttered.
So, yeah, so you mentioned one of the challenges that people have, which is storage and clutter, but what are some other challenges you can face when you do have a small space?
Look, I think it's really about that flexibility in terms of having that, you know, being afforded a nice view and everything. And I think it's really important that we have medium density residential. We obviously, we have a lot of people who need homes, and we do need to sort of pack in a bit in the city. But, you know, I'm disappointed with some of the larger buildings where there's, you're not offering any someone in an apartment sunlight or a good outlook or things like that. And I think that we have to focus on that, that you, that every little apartment needs to have something really positive about it, you know, rather than just being a little box in another box, you know, on top of other boxes, against other boxes.
I guess, yeah, when if you're developing an apartment or a series of apartments, an apartment complex, trying to make sure that each apartment or each building, each space has something that's positive about it, not just a space.
That's right. I think it's pretty tough, I think, to put a small apartment on the southern side of a building looking at a brick wall, you know, and they're going to happen, and they're going to probably be the least expensive one to purchase. But I think we can do better than that.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything you can do if you do get the southern facing, brick facing apartment, in cheapest apartment in the complex? What can you do, I guess, to try and make it a bit more comfortable, a bit nicer to live in?
Yeah, look, I think that's a really good question, Gabriella, because I think otherwise I'm kind of painting you into a corner if that's the one you can afford, and I totally get it. I think when my husband and I were buying our first little house in Sydney, we kind of knew that we had to have something on a busy road or near a train track, and we ended up with something under the flight path. That was, you know, something in Sydney. So we totally understood that was where we were sitting.
Mm-hmm.
But in this respect, yes, I think that's when interior design is so important. You know, just a beautiful curtain that you can pull across the windows that might go across the whole wall. So sometimes something like that can really help the room feel bigger. It might be a sheer that you can sort of half look out, but it gives the room a really cozy warmth. There's lots of different things, you know, and then if you are, say, looking and there's a little balcony, you can create a kind of green screen again to the balcony. Mm-hmm. So, yes, there's no writing off this kind of thing. It's more directed at developers that they, you know, or planners, architects, that we have to do better to begin with. But, yes, when you have one of those little apartments, there's plenty you can do.
So I imagine as well that, you know, how much light we get, how we feel about the space and how it functions is going to affect our sort of well-being and our health. Do you know how these things can affect us? And, does it affect us?
Look, it was really interesting for me working on the Royal Children's Hospital, because the health planning part of the architecture team, which I was not, were much more sort of on top of this. And it's definitely been understood in that hospital environment that really beautiful interiors, natural light, you know, really very much promote wellness and actually help people get better faster. So I think we have to see that these sort of environments have an impact on how well we're doing.
So is it including things like light, like just a beautifully functioning, well-designed space? Those are enough?
Yeah, look, I think natural light's really important. And I think we can understand that if it's sort of a gloomy space, I think we have to think about a perception of security. So you've got to consider people's acoustic privacy. You know, you don't want to listen to someone next door or feel infringed upon. You need to sort of feel secure in your own space and to have an outlook, you know, to feel that you're in your little haven and, you know, able to sort of have a prospect outwards, to sort of look outwards but also be contained.
As far as acoustics, does that just mean having enough, I guess, insulation between buildings or between living spaces?
Yeah, look, I think it's been, it's good. They have actually improved the building codes around this over time, because it was understood that, you know, we have more powerful televisions and speakers and things. you know, we have to think about someone upstairs stomping around, you know, that sort of noise. And that's in apartments. You know, when we're living next door to people in homes, anywhere, we can all have our lives a little bit impacted if we have noisy neighbours, parties, you know, this sort of thing. So you can design away a fair bit, and even your perception, you know, definitely, like we got double glazing at the back of our house, and I just couldn't believe the difference to sort of have a double glazed home. I mean, obviously it's still, you can hear noise, but it just feels more muted and softer, not like you're sort of sitting like we had before, that if our neighbour played loud music at the back of our house, used to sort of shake
a little bit,
like just rattle a little bit, like the back doors.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, it wasn't great music, but.
Yes, in my apartment complex, I've thankfully got really great windows, so it makes a huge difference. I think there was a siren once going off for ages, or someone was hooting their horn, and I closed the window and all of a sudden it was so much quieter. Unfortunately, people who live directly next to us, so we share a living room wall, I don't think there's any insulation there, so we can hear when they play loud music.
That's a bit naughty. Like in new apartments, that shouldn't happen, because there has been, they have actually really improved the building codes around that. It's a terrible impediment, I think, if, you know, to have that. And it is about your privacy.
Yeah. And it also makes me feel a bit self-conscious, I think. My terrible music taste, and then listening to my music, and I'm like, are they judging me? Can they hear this?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, you sort of, we all have to be reasonable when we're living in close quarters to each other. So there's definite sort of courtesies for each other. But you know, it can be assisted by having well-constructed buildings.
And I will say that they're actually great. They don't play music late at night. It's maybe, I think, on a Sunday morning sometimes. And honestly, they should just have fun sometimes. And
yeah,
I hope they think the same for me.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we've got a big family next door. So, you know, there's often stuff going on there. And I just kind of think, oh, that's, you know, that's the family and that's how they live. And, you know, that's, I never let it really worry me. But I think it's when you get woken up at midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning with someone, you know, playing loud music or know, yelling on the street, that you're never feeling as generous then.
Yes, there was one time when there was a party going on at midnight, and thankfully someone else in my apartment complex actually knocked on their door and said, hello, can you please be quiet?
Yeah.
So I didn't have to go up, but do you mind sharing some success stories from your from Studio Esther, and how you've managed to transform some, you know, smaller spaces into really livable areas?
Well, look, we've worked on houses of all sorts of scales and some little apartments and things like that. So it's been really enjoyable to take on each thing as a challenge, and really, you know, it's certainly the biggest reward when you have a client that's very happy with their space. I think an interesting one for me was reorganising quite significantly a semi-detached house, where we just took away a big corridor, which the client had identified was sort of eating up a lot of space to not much use. So. We relocated the entry to the house just down the side of the house so that we could then take that corridor and put it back into the rooms. Mm-hmm. So that our client was able to gain a walk-in robe and an ensuite. And so it gave them a second bathroom, which was really helpful for them. And that was a really fun project, actually, because it's a very inner city sort of house, and just that sort of reworking pretty much the same floor plate and what we could get out of it. And we really did sort of like every little bit, you know, we were sort of storage and things like that. And the clients were terrific to work with. So, we've got another project which has been very interesting, where our clients, I think, have been very brave and very consistent with who they are, that we have designed a small house for them. So probably like a small apartment in the proportions of the rooms and things, but it actually is a little house. And that's just been terrific. I just have enjoyed it so much. It really has got everything they need and not anything extra.
Mm-hmm.
But part of that has been having a little breakout space for their kids upstairs. So they're on the ground floor with the living and dining kitchen, but their children upstairs with a little breakout space and a little balcony, you know, not big spaces, but just little places to be, which as a family of four gives them that separation that they need from each other, but also, you know, places to come together.
And I guess that's something we haven't really discussed is I think we have a little bit with privacy, but I guess we do need spaces in, within our homes for privacy but also coming together. Is that something that you often think about when you're designing redesigning houses?
Yeah, look, very much. I think that we're sort of looking at, I think sometimes balancing the space, but also I think about offering that you're offering different experiences in the space, just as we have different moods or personalities or you know, times of the day, that we can reflect that in the way that we design a home, that we might have the public space, you know, that, you know, where everyone's going to come together and hang out and watch telly or sit around a dinner table, but there might be other areas where we can draw away to have quieter time. They don't have to be big spaces, but they might just be a little separate space. And I think it's something that really came to the fore during the COVID lockdown in Melbourne, that many people were at home all day and, you know, with whoever else, you know, like groups having to find some privacy within homes and finding that they could to make these smaller little areas, like that didn't have to be a separate room, but just creating those little breakouts and things, I think.
So in Melbourne, we had those really big lockdowns. And during that time, I realised I hadn't really been alone by myself for like 3 months, except in the car when I was driving, which I don't really think is a nice, calm, fun time, because my partner couldn't leave the house. I was leaving the house because I was working, so he got some alone time. But I think I asked him to like go for a walk so I could just be by myself for a little while. So, yeah, I appreciate the fact that, yeah, we do obviously need to design place rooms and spaces for us to be alone and have some alone time.
Yeah, look, I am a number of years ago, when we first moved into our little house, because we'd come from Sydney, we were quite happy with a two-bedroom house because Sydney does have smaller homes. And as our daughters got older, coming back to the Barbie movie, we'd been given so many Barbie dolls, like everyone's leftovers, and we were just dominated in our living area with this sort of – and I sort of organised the littlest attic, like we literally – inexpensively went up into the roof and just lined it out and made this little room upstairs and put, you know, all the Barbie dolls and everything up there and invariably a little television up there. And then during the COVID lockdown, I was up there. I eventually worked it out. I thought I can go up there and have my study because otherwise I was at the dining table with one of my daughters who was doing VCE. And I mean, I love her, but I got tired. I was listening to all her lessons all day.
Oh, gosh, that would be annoying. So it was just you and all the Barbies in the attic.
That's right.
I love that. I love that. Is there anything that we've missed that you wanted to discuss?
Look, I think what I was going to sort of talk about was just a little bit about lighting. And mm-hmm. when we were talking about looking out at the brick wall or sort of not having a great aspect, I did want to sort of just mention that it's really worth investing in some really beautiful lights. And mm-hmm. that's part of that sort of the way that we live in space, our the way we feel about natural light, but also generally about lighting. Having some very beautiful light quality in a space will really change the way you feel in the space. So it's really important to put some time to that. It's not necessarily an expensive thing to do, but you can kind of layer light. So you've got what we call a sort of more ambient light where you might have some soft lighting. I mean, I love having the LED under my kitchen cupboards on all the time. That's one of my, and because I've got a sort of terracotta coloured splashback tile, it just gives this little warm backdrop when we might just be watching telly and most of the other lights are off. So that's kind of like a little bit of ambient lighting, although it's also terrific task lighting for the benchtop. Perhaps a beautiful pendant light over a dining table. You know, thinking about all of that. So I'm always a bit disappointed when I see there's definitely room for downlights, absolutely, but I'm disappointed when I see ceilings just riddled with downlights because there are nicer ways to light spaces and it's worth putting some thought into.
So I'm currently in a rented apartment and at night sometimes I feel a little sad because we've got one sort of central light in the middle of the room and I don't know if it's because the shade is dirty even though I cleaned it recently or the light bulb just isn't particularly strong, but it always feels very dim in that room. Are there any sort of renter-friendly ways of bringing more light when you can't, you know, introduce a pendant light into the room?
Look, I think a couple of lamps make a huge difference. So one thing would be to have a lamp that you can flick up and actually light your ceiling. Sometimes the space feels gloomy because the contrast of the light projecting downwards can make the ceiling very dark. So sort of reflecting some light off the ceiling can be a really effective way of lighting a space. Mm-hmm. And another thing is just a very beautiful light, lamp, you know, so introducing some beautiful lamps. And, you know, we don't really have our living room lighting on very much. We actually just have a little table lamp in the corner, which tends to be all that we want. It might be through age, I don't need that harsh light, but I think that you know, using lamps are a really nice way to introduce some beautiful light quality into rooms.
Mm. And for your home, do you recommend any sort of like colours of lights? I believe there's like cool tones and there's warm tones and natural tones.
Oh, look, I'm a big fan of the warm tone. So we talk about Kelvins, which is a measure of the colour of the light. And definitely when you're doing task lighting or something in an office, you'll always, you know, notice that you've got quite white light, which starts to sort of emulate daylight, which is very bright, but it's probably not, doesn't feel as nice as daylight. In a more domestic context, I'd always be moving into the warmer colours.
Okay. I'll have to see if I can find any lamps. I'll have to have a look at my op shop.
Yeah, absolutely. They bring so much colour and character to the space.
Great. So in your own home, what is a practice you do to manage your home?
Oh, look, I think I am someone who, whilst I talk about appreciating clutter, I think for me, I tend to try to put everything away. Mm-hmm. So it's just sort of part of a bit of a ritual that I probably do like everything to be put away. I think it's because I married quite a tidy man and I've learned over time, I've been indoctrinated to, yes, having everything has a place.
Mm-hmm. And how often do you tidy up? Is it, you know, once a week, once a month, once a day?
I think part of my leaving the house in the morning, because I've worked full time for a long time, and it is that feeling of leaving the house in the morning, having everything in its place to sort of come home in the evening and to sort of feel like, oh, that's nice. Like I'm walking into a calm environment. I don't want to see things in the sink. And my poor daughter coming back from uni where she just wants to slob around a bit. I sort of get really frustrated if she's not cleaned up after herself, you know, so you probably do get a little bit too habituated to it.
I mean, I think I am both people in the situation because I hate coming home and there's mess everywhere. But also when I come home and I, like, you know, I make a sandwich or something and I just leave everything there and then my partner comes home and, you know, then he's like, oh, I have to clean all the dishes now.
Yeah, it can be a little bit obsessive if you're not careful. And I certainly feel like I need everything in its place before I can do anything else, because I like to come home early evening and I might do a little bit of work at the dining table and think about cooking and things, but I can only really relax if I feel like everything's put away. Yes, so I'm not sure if that's not a recommendation, but that's certainly how we, you know.
But that is a challenge. Are there any other challenges to this practice?
Oh, look, I think it is about sort of balance, really, isn't it? You're always trying to balance. You don't want to become too obsessively tidy that you can't relax. But at the same time, I think if you have too much clutter around, you probably can feel disorganized, and possibly it's something to have some, you know, to give some thought to.
We're going to do the open mic section next. So that's where you, the guest, get to talk about something that you're passionate about. It doesn't have to be related to our topic today, but it can be. Did you have something in mind?
Oh, look, I think I am, you know, I touched on before a little bit about, you know, when we start designing, that there's this greater context, you know, that when we start looking at, you know, how do we set up a house and the plan and everything, we're sort of looking at that site analysis, as we call it. But I mean, part of that greater context is thinking about every home as being part of a community. And I do sort of feel passionately that whilst, you know, I think there have been mistakes made in the past in letting architects sort of design utopian sort of areas. You know, this hasn't always been ideal. But we do have to recognise that the way that we arrange sort of residential areas and how they're put together and how they're placed can help create community. And I think there's been a lot of focus on loneliness with more single person households. And I think that that's something that can really be countered by the way that we arrange residential areas to sort of really promote more communal kind of, you know, more ability to come together.
So how do you promote that? Is it as simple as, I don't know, having a communal area for people to use together?
Look, I think there's been a lot of work done in the area of this. So I'm not a super expert on the exact numbers, but there is a way of thinking about areas that you offer a variety of home types. So you might have single houses that are quite large. You might have smaller houses. You might then have, you know, townhouses, terrace houses, apartments. And it's really great to have a mix of those things. And then think about a sort of within those zones that you might provide communal open space. You can also provide degrees of private space. So you might have a small section of an apartment building able to use a shared space. And then that might sort of, there might be different scales of that. So then there might be a bigger space that's part of the kind of neighbourhood. Mm-hmm. So you're sort of creating these opportunities for people to come across each other. But also by bringing a number of people into a community, it helps little businesses set up. You end up with a local cafe because you want to generate enough population that they can support that. So you and I were talking a little bit about Brunswick because we both know it well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Brunswick is a successful example because it has larger family homes, smaller homes, little, you know, and then a lot of townhouses, apartments and things. But as a result of that, you've got very active parkland, you've got cafes that can thrive, you've got little local shops and things that can come off the back of that population because it's a walkable area. And then even within an apartment building, nice to have not too many apartments so that there's an opportunity to get to know your neighbours or to see the same faces. And you might have shared communal zones within the apartments. So some of the ones that they've introduced in Brunswick have shared laundries and shared gardens, shared, you know. So without too many people, there's an opportunity to that if you're someone who would like to meet your neighbours, someone who'd like to have a little bit of life from that can actually be promoted. So, you know, I think it's quite understood how that can happen, and I think it's an important thing that we focus on creating really quality residential areas, not too kind of crammed in, you know. Mm.
Yeah, I've noticed that a lot of my my own interactions with my neighbours is we are using the shared laundry line.
Yeah.
You know, we'll both be down there. We'll like say, oh, hi, how's it going? Oh, what a lot of wind we had the other day.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
That sort of, you know, just chatting with our neighbours, whereas I used to live with my parents in Brighton, which for anyone who's not in Melbourne is quite a rich area. And I found that a lot of the building or a lot of the homes, very large, beautiful homes, had these big fences between all the different buildings. And I felt like there wasn't as much community. Maybe it was because I wasn't the right type of person to be in that community, being a bit older than the kids and a bit younger than the parents.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what I really loved about coming to Brighton, to Brunswick, was I felt there was a bit more of a community there and a bit more opportunity to have those shared spaces, you know, in the parks and, you know, in our own apartment complex with the laundry line.
Yeah, look, you know, I think some of the problems when you've got large areas where they're just a swathe of single homes is that it has to be a car supported community because you're not having that opportunity to just walk because it's not enough population density to support a local shop or a local cafe. So people then are tending to just come in and out of that community in their cars. And obviously then you're really missing that sort of incidental meeting of people and you don't have, say, a local cafe or something. And for some people living on their own, that ability to walk up the street and even to know the person who serves them a coffee can be one of their only interactions they have, you know. So those are really quite important and it's something that we can manage and control.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that with the having the population to support businesses and also the walkability. That's really interesting.
Yeah, look, I think we've had a previous pattern where, you know, you've just got as you move further and further out of the city, you're just getting people who just want to, it's like, I want a single home. But you also then have an issue when people become more elderly and they can't look after a house anymore, that for them to stay in that community, it might work for them to move into an apartment that's still part of that community. And then that in turn increases the density of that community.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. Thank you.
I think the making of cities is something very interesting to me.
Yeah, thank you. I'm going to think about that. And thank you so much for talking with me today. If people want to find out more about you and Studio Esther, where can they find you?
So we've got a website with some of our work on it and we've got a little bit of an Instagram thing running, I think. I've been a bit old school with everything and it's a terrible, you know, indictment of my age, but I'm trying to be a little more social media savvy.
Mm-hmm. We'll make sure that your website and your social media links will be in our show notes so our listeners can find you if they're interested.
Oh, thank you very much, Gabriella.
Thank you for joining me today.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Room by Room, produced by the Home Organisation Science Labs, a division of LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. More episodes like this from across 10 life management perspectives can be found by searching LMSL on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube, Spotify, and other podcasting apps available on your smart devices. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider rating our show, sharing it, and subscribing to our channel, as it helps other people find it so we can grow and bring you more quality resources. More of our work can be found on our website at ho.lmsl.net, where you can join our movement. I'm Gabriella Yastra. Thanks for tuning in.